BCFM 93.2. We love this city.
Early Neolithic lake dwellings which have been dug up in Switzerland, where we find poppy heads, which looks as though people were already using this most ancient and powerful and most dangerous of narcotics, even in the days before the rise of agriculture, so that man was apparently a dope addict before he was a farmer.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. He was a one-off, some have said about Councillor Ron Stone, but is it so strange to think the council should still build social housing? After all, as we've just been discussing, we do need it more than ever. Councillor Stone was Labour's spokesman on housing and seemed to be one of the few politicians in the city to make genuine efforts and actions to tackle the housing racket, seeing it as the basic job of the council to see every Bristolian has somewhere decent to live. So in a minute we'll be joined by Grenville Johnson and Fabian Breckles, both from Ron Stone's area of St George, to pay tribute to the life and work of the Councillor Stone, who died unexpectedly while at the BRI for tests over the holiday. Before that, we'll take a quick scoot round the world, though, with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. First of all, Martin, big news for me is hydrogen bombs going off in North Korea. Now, there's been a bit of doubt thrown about this by the Foreign Office and by the Western media generally, but it seems pretty clear they do have nuclear capability and they've done some sort of an underground test.
Yeah, well, I've got a source, which I cannot name, that tells me where North Korea has got its nuclear weapons from. People will have to just take my word for it, whether what this source is telling me. It may or may not be true.
Well, it's worth mentioning. It is out there online, isn't it?
It is out there online. There's interviews with me about this online if people want to check on it. I can't give you the name of my source. But what I'm being told is that they've basically bought these nuclear weapons on the black market, and they had one lot of nuclear weapons which were uranium-based nuclear weapons, which were bought originally from the South African stockpile, and were sold to them by John Bredenkamp, who is a arms dealer from South Africa.
Well, it's worth mentioning, isn't it, that when the black majority rule started in South Africa, there was a nervousness amongst the whites that, oh goodness, you know, we can't let the ANC get their hands on these.
Yes, and Magnus Malan, who was the defence minister, approached the British and the Americans and said, look, we've got 9 nuclear warheads here, which they developed in association with the Israelis at Pelindaba, and these were uranium-based atom bombs rather than hydrogen bombs. And he said, we will sell them to you to get them off our hands. And a deal was done, and 6 were bought by the Americans and taken, as far as we know, to America and dismantled. 3 were sold to the British government, but they were sold via an intermediary, Astra Holdings, which was run by a former MI6 officer called Stephen Koch. And the 3 nuclear weapons were sold to Astra Holdings, who then sold them on to the British government. They sold them to the British government for £50 million, and they bought them from Arms Corps, the South African arms company, for £30 million. So there's a £20 million profit.
Well, is there anything here that makes you think that this is not a cock and bull story?
Well, I mean, I've been given lots of evidence. I mean, I've been talking to this chap now for 5 years, and he's an insider, and he's given me lots of documentation.
Well, when
and
you
evidence.
Say an insider, how far inside?
Well, this chap was involved in arms to South Africa. You know, when there was an arms embargo on South Africa, lots of people in this country were in fact involved in supplying weaponry to the South African government. He was one of those, which is why he knows an awful lot about what went on. John Bredenkamp, incidentally, lives in Kilmersdown, not far from here, as does another chap called Billy Reutenbach, both of whom were in the Rhodesian SAS during the Liberation War in Zimbabwe.
Yeah, this is in the middle of sleepy Somerset.
Yes, well, don't forget that, sir, think about the relationship between the Tory squirearchy here and the sort of deep state in South Africa. Think about Mark Thatcher involved in the potential overthrow of the government of Guinea in West Africa, and then arrested by the South African.
Well, look, I mean, if we've got international arms dealers in the middle of Somerset, don't you think Avon and Somerset Police would have taken an interest in that?
Well, I mean, they have been notified, actually, some of them. I mean, I'm sure some others are. Anyway, there's a big story here, but I'm just briefly summarising. Now, what I've been told is that the first bomb that North Koreans exploded was one of these, which had originally been in the hands of South Africa, passed through the hands of Astra Holdings, because the three weapons that were sold to the British government never arrived there. They went to Oman and were put in storage there. Dr. David Kelly went out to check that they were there and found that, in actual fact, the three warheads that the British government had bought were not there. It was just concrete.
Well, David Kelly was the guy who was found dead in the woods.
That's
just
the
before
one.
At the time of the beginning
That's
of the Iraq
one.
War, yeah.
And it's suggested to me by my contact that his knowledge about this is more to do with his disappearance than anything else. And then Bredenkamp turned round to he was dealing with Tory grandees, Sir Kenneth Warren, David Cameron, when he was 22, and Dr. David Kelly went out to South Africa to do this deal. So David Cameron himself was involved.
Well, he was working, I think.
Well, he was working for Tory Central Office as a 22-year-old. Anyway, the point is that the weapons never actually came to Britain in the end. Bredenkamp turned round to the British government and Astra Holdings, which was a holding company, which was actually a subsidiary of Astra Fireworks, if people remember Astra Fireworks. And they said, well, look, we've paid you, 30 million quid for these three warheads, and they're not there. And they said, well, this is an illegal deal, chaps. What are you going to do, call the cops? And, of course, they didn't call the cops. So that was one source of the uranium or atom bomb, which was the first bomb that was exploded by North Korea, because Bredenkamp had sold it on to them. Now, what this is a second set of nuclear weapons that went missing, which were plutonium warheads of United States manufacture that ended up in the sea off Somalia during the first Gulf War. They were the B-52 bomber that was flying them caught fire, and they ditched the bombs in the sea. But those bombs were then taken off the seabed by Billy Reutenbach, who's an associate of John Bredenkamp, both of whom were in the Rhodesian SAS, both of whom are now based in Kilmersdown, because he was supplying weaponry to Somalia. They're arms dealers. He was supplying weapons into Somalia, and what they were doing was dropping weapons into the sea off Somalia, then retrieving them and plying. And so they found these things.
Well, I know we had an interview with the investigative journalist Roger Cook, who was over in Russia, in Ukraine, I think, actually, after the fall of the Soviet Union, where their army hadn't been paid, and he was actually offered an SS-20 missile launcher, which was actually shown to him, and that was actually on TV, and the tapes then disappeared as part of the Cook report. So it does look like there is
a black market in nuclear weapons.
I think we can presume that.
Well, I mean, yes, but we can presume that there is one. Now, the point is that the North Koreans, this is why we've got the North Koreans are saying it's an H-bomb. It is an H-bomb, but they haven't actually got the facilities to explode it as an H-bomb. So what they do is they just blow up the H-bomb. And, of course, it's sending a message to the Americans, we've got the missiles that you, the warheads that you lost in 1991.
Because
the Americans will be able to tell from analysing the radiation profile
that it is one of their bombs.
I think
it's an underground test.
It's quite possible to identify the individual bomb once you've got the profile. And so the North Koreans are sending a message to the Americans, all of those weapons that you lost off Somalia in 1991, they were scooped up by Bredenkamp and Reutenbach. They've sold them on to us. We've got them.
Well, the hidden hidden intrigues of sleepy Somerset.
I don't know whether any of this is true. I've only got one source for it, but it's a source that's given me lots and lots of information to back up.
Well,
what
I know you did point out that some of the questions had been asked about this, and they were on the record in Hansard.
Well, in Hansard, Doug Hoyle, who was an Labour MP, was tipped off to ask the government where the Tory party had got £17 million from before the 1992 election. They couldn't account for it. That £17 million was the profit that had been made by Astra Holdings on the intermediary between the British government and Alms Corps.
Well, maybe we should put a call into Avon and Somerset, see if they've got any information on this. Also, Martin, the Turkish president has stuck his foot in his mouth, didn't he, by discussing Hitler's Germany in public as if it was a good system of government. That's Erdogan.
Yes, well, I mean, he's a very interesting character, isn't he? I mean, I think that's pretty typical of the kind of thing that he's likely to say. Incidentally, Erdogan said about Charlie Hebdo attack, and he may be right about this, he saw the hand of Mossad behind the Charlie Hebdo attack. Now, that's the president of Turkey. And you might say, oh, that's a crazy, he's an Islamist, he's saying silly things. In Turkey, everybody knows that the Ergonican networks run by NATO were behind all the terrorism in Italy in the 70s, 80s and 90s.
In Turkey?
In Turkey, yeah. They would go around, blow things up, pretending to be Islamists. And it was all orchestrated by NATO intelligence, the Ergonican networks, as they were called in Turkey. And several top generals in Turkey were sent to prison by the Erdogan government for being involved in this kind of thing. And everybody in Turkey, Kurdish or Turkish, knows that NATO does in fact engage in false flag terrorism. So when the Suruk bombing happened some weeks ago, you know, last year, which they killed all these Kurdish militants who were at a youth rally, the PKK, the Kurdish separatists, immediately identified two Turkish intelligence officers which they thought were behind the bombing, even though it was claimed by ISIS. They assassinated them, and that broke the ceasefire that PKK and the central government in Turkey had for several years. And we've now got a full-on war going on in eastern Turkey, in which hundreds of people have been killed in the last two or three weeks. But we've heard nothing about it, because it's a war that we're fighting, and therefore we don't need to know about it.
Well, another thing we haven't heard much about is the way that the Egyptian government has been shutting down arts venues right across the country. These are pioneering what they call galleries and raiding independent publishing houses in the run-up to the anniversary of the Arab Spring, just coming up any week now.
Well, yes, and of course the murder of the Shia cleric in Saudi Arabia is another fallout from the Arab Spring. He led the protests in the eastern provinces against the government in Riyadh, and of course the eastern province in Saudi Arabia
you
is
mean the beheading.
The beheading of
judicial beheading, yeah. Apparently.
But I mean, the significance of the person who was beheaded was that he was the leader of the
Sheikh Nima Al Nima.
Okay, I couldn't remember the name, but he led the protests in the eastern provinces of Saudi Arabia against the regime in Riyadh. Now, in actual fact, most people don't realise that the oil field in Saudi Arabia is right up against the Gulf there. Most of Saudi Arabia hasn't got any oil. That's where the oil is, and the majority in that province are Shia. They're not Sunni. So if we're going to start breaking countries up, you know, Kosovo here, breaking up Syria and all the rest of it, maybe Kurdistan having to be broken out of Iraq and all the rest of it, it's quite possible that you could get a Shia-led breakaway in that region, which would get the oil. Yeah. So in other words, the House of Saud would then be out, and you'd get a new state emerging just across the causeway from Bahrain, which is also another majority.
A lot of these regimes, I mean, I mentioned Egypt area. As well there, seem to be very fragile, don't they? I mean, El-Sisi, for example, he was the defence minister under the previous president, and then we had the Muslim Brotherhood in power. Mubarak's defence minister now in charge of the country. It's almost as if the Arab Spring never happened. No wonder they're getting nervous.
Well, it is. I mean, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, which is being savagely repressed, thousands of them have been killed, many of them have been sentenced to death by kangaroo courts. They were the elected government of Egypt. What if they were to take up arms against the evil dictatorship of Mubarak, just as people have done in Syria? Can they expect support from British Special Forces? Will the RAF be flying close air support as they take on the Egyptian army? No, they won't, because the Egyptian army are our allies. In Syria, when people take up arms against the government, we understand. Sometimes people have just got to fight. When Gaddafi was wasn't even judicially murdered, he was shot through the head after being mutilated supposedly by rebels, but many people suspect by French or British Special Forces. Hillary Clinton said, "We came, we saw, he died," and then she laughed. Now, what would we say if somebody say that the CC government, which is, they did win an election, but the opposition were banned. Assad has won an election in Syria, and he tried to encourage as many people to participate as possible. And that's why the Russians, for example, are quite calm about having an election in Syria. They know that Assad is going to win. If there was a free election in Egypt, it wouldn't be clear that Sisi would win. But of course, Sisi's our ally. But of course, if the moderate Muslims of the Muslim Brotherhood, just like the moderate Muslims of the Muslim Brotherhood in Syria, were to take up arms against the Egyptian government, because we've encouraged them to fight in Syria, if we've said Assad's got to go, otherwise he's just got to be blown up, shot, or whatever, because we're not talking about gentle change here, gradual change, we want revolutionary change. Assad's got to go. Okay. Well, Sisi's got to go. Well, the head of the Saudi government's got to go, and I mean next week, otherwise we're going to blow them up, aren't we? The British Special Forces and the RAF will be in there, backing them up to clear away the dead wood, and we're going to have democracy all round, aren't we? Oh, yeah, and by the way, the Israelis are going to withdraw from all the occupied territories, because we're revolutionaries. We're revolutionaries in Syria. We're not going to accept any kind of gradualism. Assad's got to go, he's got to go. Well, everything, everybody's got to go then.
Martin,
a whole lot.
Martin, how do you see things playing out in Syria then?
Well, what's going to happen in Syria?
In a nutshell.
In a nutshell, the Russians have played a very smart move. They know that Assad has actually got majority support. There was a NATO internal document that was leaked, which said, well, our internal assessment is about 70% of the population support the government, about 10% support the rebels, and the rest of them don't know. And that's why the Russians are saying, well, we're happy to have, once we've defeated terrorists in Syria, because most of the terrorists in Syria are from outside. They've been infiltrated in by the Gulf Cooperation Council and NATO countries like Turkey, with the support of MI6 and CIA, of course. We're not against terrorism, we're just against the wrong kind of terrorism.
So how do you see it all ending up then?
Well, I think that the Russians have actually checkmated them, because they can't beat Assad. And in actual fact, the British, for example, the British involvement in the war, the overt involvement of the RAF, they've carried out 3 bombing raids, and they haven't carried out any since the new year. And that's because Syrian air defences will shoot down those tornadoes like partridges. Now, maybe the Russians won't shoot. They'll let them fly over as long as they're not attacking their Syrian army positions.
And what about the
oil?
But
on the other hand, it's pretty dangerous, because they will be shot down no problem.
What about the oil? Will Rupert Murdoch get his oil in the Golan Heights? Will he start drilling that?
Well, the Golan Heights turns out to be full of oil, and at the same time, there's a multinational company called Genie, which intends to exploit that oil, which is also involved, incidentally, in the ISIS oil scam via Turkey. And the people running Genie are Dick Cheney, Murdoch, and others.
And Jacob Rothschild.
And Jacob Rothschild. In actual fact, of course, the Golan Heights is officially part of Syria. And under international law, they have no right to develop those oil fields. But big gas fields have also been discovered in the eastern Mediterranean. The Israelis are trying to take the gas fields off Lebanon and off Egypt. There's a potential for a big war here. But it will be a big war. It won't be a walkover. It won't be a cakewalk like Iraq. You will be going head-to-head with the Syrian army that have taken 60,000 casualties, fighting for 4 years, and the Russians. And you know what? If the British Army and the US Army and the Israeli Army want to take those people on, they will lose. And I think that will eventually be the solution here, because the bullies will eventually be forced to recognise that they've got to back down.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
So, he was a one-off, some people have said, about Councillor Ron Stone. But is it so strange to think the council should build social housing when we need it more than ever? I'm joined in the studio now by Fabian Breckles. I'll introduce you to start with, Fabian. Hi, welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And also Grenville Johnson. Grenville, could you just tell us a bit about yourself? Fabian is a city councillor for the Labour Party. How come you knew Ron?
Well, way back in the early 1970s, when I was a newly appointed primary teacher, I was teaching in Brislington. I taught Ron's son, I knew his wife, so I knew the family. This was way before Ron was elected as a councillor. So I've known Ron all those years. I live in St George. He's encouraged me to work on numerous community projects and keenly supported me. So as a result, we've also became very close friends as well.
What about the gardening aspect? I mean, this is something, obviously, when we just interview Ron here about politics, we didn't realise he was quite into his gardening too.
He was. He was a great gardener, actually. Over the years, he had won numerous awards. He grew roses and entered lots of competitions and shows. And I think at one point they said to him, give it a rest because you've won so many awards. So he used to come and help us and bring trowels into my street in Kenston Road, and where we set a community garden there. And he'd come along in his own free time and just help with some gardening. So that's the type of man he was.
Tell us a bit about this group's St George in Bloom.
My street won top awards over 6 years, and Ron said to me, he called me Sunshine, and he used to say, Sunshine, what are you going to do now? And I said, well, Ron, you're setting me the challenge. So I said, I need to think about this. And I set up St George in Bloom 2 years ago, and he was a very keen advocate and supporter, because he realised that it wasn't just about pretty flowers, window boxes, hanging baskets. He saw the potential for bringing whole communities together, people of all faiths, cultures, and St George is a very diverse community, which is brilliant. And he saw this as a way of celebrating and bringing people together and making St George a better place and encouraging civic pride as well.
What about the neighbourhood partnership? Some people are quite sceptical about just how democratic these are, but what was, you know, Ron's involvement with that?
Well, I worked with Ron and Fabian and other councillors. It was a huge honour, really, because Ron basically had the idea of forming neighbourhood partnerships to give local democracy, to give people a say and a chance to influence decision-making at local level. And he was the first chair. He handed over to me. Fabian was the vice chair. He actually wanted people to make a difference, to have a say, and to help the councillors to make democratic decisions, to make Bristol a better place, and certainly his ward. He worked tirelessly for the ward in this respect.
Give us an idea practically of what someone who lived in St George could expect if they came along to the neighbourhood partnership.
Well, Ron would listen. He was a very compassionate man. He would listen very carefully. I think with his experience of being a councillor for 30 years, you know, he wasn't a pushover, but certainly he was very compassionate. And, you know, if he saw a need, he would listen, he would help. And I think he'd go out of his way to help people. Basically, community groups benefited all over the place. He'd make sure that they were properly funded, that they were properly set up. He would help. He became involved with them on a practical level. So he went way beyond the normal regime of type of workload that the councillor would do. He got in there. He was practical. He rolled up his sleeves and got involved with them and helped them.
Well, isn't there a certain amount of frustration in the city that however much Ron is prepared to listen, actually it's a bit like an elected dictatorship now?
Well, he actually fought against that.
He
really pushed the boundaries there, and, you know, he wouldn't stand for that nonsense. And I'll hand over to Fabian, really.
Yeah, I mean, Ron was someone who if he sort of got hold of something, he wouldn't let it go. I mean, one example, I mean, Graham has talked about the neighbourhood partnerships. Ron's actually responsible for a lot of the funding the partnerships in Bristol got to spend, because when he found out the previous Lib Dem administration was sitting on Section 106 money, that's the money that developers pay towards community improvements when they get planning permission, you know, things like money for crossings and stuff like that, he doggedly persisted in chasing the money, challenging the council about how much was involved, and he kept on and on and on and on until it was actually got released and spent on the and released new neighbourhood partnerships, and that's where a lot of the funding's gone. So, you know, come from. So, if it wasn't for him, we'd be basically penniless talking shops. So, that's a lasting legacy we've got from Ron. I mean, he's been my councillor since '96. I first knew him '95 to '97 when I was first elected on the council briefly in Cotton, and he took me under his wing and guided me through some of the more obscure parts of being a councillor, and he's got a record of being a very good source of encouragement and advice to new councillors and people who new to the role.
Now, one of the things you're saying there about actually trying to get to the bottom of the city accounts, this is something I think some of the officers sometimes, Fabian, don't really want, isn't it? If you're actually saying, well, hang on, where did that money go? And Ron is there saying, well, we want that back. And in fact, they're saying they're saying the same exact sort of thing down in Avonmouth right now. They're saying, well, you know, you've sold the Bristol Port, now let's have some of that money back here.
Yeah, and we actually, as a council, throughout rejected the Bristol Port sale, but George Ferguson, nice listening Democrat that he is, took no notice and went ahead and sold it. So he's got himself a £9 million campaign pot or something like that. It just the whole thing stinks. I mean, it was so short term. But there were, you know, scrutiny with this current regime is very much a problem.
Was Ron actually able to engage and get information out of the city council? This is another thing that we've seen since the election of Mayor Ferguson. Is it's actually they're not quite so free and open with their information. I mean, for example, things like the Public Property Board, I think it's called, and other groups, the Local Enterprise Partnership. These are actually starting to manage large amounts of public money, and yet they're not even open.
The local
the
enterprise partnership was set up by the coalition government, so it's not something that's the council's or any council regime is to blame.
But how did Ron get on in dealing with this kind of gradual wall of secrecy that's been coming up in local government?
To be honest with you, most of the time when I've been working with Ron, as a St George councillor myself, I've been working with him in the community, and that's where we've been doing stuff.
Tell us about the Meadowvale Community Centre.
Yeah, okay, I'd love to. It was one thing that Ron has been championing for a long time, is the, you know, supporting efforts for the because Meadowvale is a very, very deprived area. St George is actually really rather nice. It's got some fantastic...
The bit I know more than anywhere is the park, actually. I mean, that's somewhere I've spent quite a bit of time.
But if you go up, there's Troopers Hill, which is quite a unique nature reserve. That's in the Troopers Hill Wall that I'm defending in May. You know, it's got some very, very beautiful countryside in it. But Meadowvale is a very deprived area in Bristol. And it's got a community centre which is basically a converted shed, brick shed, for want of anything. It's hopelessly out of date, doesn't meet community needs. And Ron has been championing to try and get money for it. And and it's starting to move forward. Because the four councillors and the Lord Partnership agreed to provide match funding for them and also for Dundridge Park, which is in my ward, and gave both Meadowvale and Dundridge Park the support of a professional fundraiser to help improve their chances of bidding for money, because what we do is we provide something like, you know, 10-15 grand, and they then use that, and then if they can then say we've got this money, they can then go to charities and groups and bid for funding. That's how these things are paid for now. So he's given them, you know, professional support, and hopefully we will get a new community centre there. It's desperately needed.
It is desperate. I think the great thing about Ron is that when he saw, you know, individuals and community champions or leaders within the community on a voluntary capacity working really hard, Ron would really go all out to support them and those groups.
Yes, he would.
And if he saw that this would be of the wider benefit, you know, he was a great, he had socialist principles, but he was a very compassionate man. He saw the big picture. He'd push those buttons. And he had his fingers on the pulse of the council, so he could determine how much money might be available, how much money might be lurking in certain pots.
No, it's interesting, because I mean, I haven't seen this side of Ron.
Yeah.
I'm chatting to him here, but it sounds to me he's almost like an impresario. He's kind of seeing that there's talent, local talent, people that want to do stuff, and he's giving them a bit of a leg up to, you know, help to help.
He
them
did.
To do it.
I mean, he was a Labour man through and through, and, you know, whether he disagreed with the leadership locally or nationally, he stayed loyal, and, you know, and he joined when Tony Benn was still the MP. And certainly I tend to follow his example as loyalty. But, I mean, his main thing was he was a community champion. If he wasn't in the council house, or we're now in Brunel House because they're gutting and refitting the council house to take more people in, but he'd be in his ward. He's basically in his ward almost all the time.
Yeah. Well, I know, for example, Fabian, he, as a close friend, he used to confide in me, and he'd pop in for coffee or tea every Saturday, and on one occasion he told me how one evening his phone rang, and this was a case of an elderly lady, an elderly person whose central heating had broken down. and the family were despairing because she was cold and she was vulnerable and so on. That lady didn't live in our ward, but Ron went out that evening and he helped her. He got the central heating sorted through, getting proper contractors in, made her a cup of tea, made sure she was warm. He told me about that. And that's the sort of level of compassion that went beyond. And I know his wife, you know, she's been incredibly supportive because she knew, his wife Jenny, she knew that he was that sort of man that would go out to be friendly, kind, caring and compassionate. And that goes beyond the brief of a councillor. And I think
yeah, it does.
He was a very humane human being. And, you know, it was a huge privilege to get to know him. He'd support you to the hilt. He wouldn't stand for nonsense. He was plain speaking, but he was kind and compassionate. And we'll miss him. He was a great councillor. You know,
yeah, I still can't get my head around the fact that he's gone. Yeah. I mean, I know he was ill, so in a way it doesn't come as a surprise, but he's still getting around it.
He earned everyone's respect. You know, yeah. people will remember him fondly because they say, "Oh, Ron, yes, he was a good guy. He worked hard. He got things done. He worked tirelessly." They recognise that, and you don't become a councillor for 30 consecutive years without those compassionate levels.
Well, one of the things I can remember Ron talking about on here was the hideous mess that is Speedwell Pool in the middle of the allotments, which was closed down.
Yeah. I'd got that down as something to raise as well, because one of the things he has been really championing is getting a replacement, because the Liberal Democrats for whatever reason shut Speedwell Pool down and thought everyone would just go over to Easton instead, which is miles away, and he's already
busy. But it's
busy
a brilliant facility. It's obviously purpose built as a pool. I mean, around about the wartime, possibly the 30s, maybe. I'm not sure.
Yeah, it looks
when.
Like it.
But obviously, purpose built as a pool. Why not just continue to use it as a pool?
I know. I mean, surely refurbishing stuff has got to be cheaper. But I mean, anyway, Ron has been sort of was championing getting a replacement, and there were plans to. Put a replacement at the new rebuilt academy in Speedwell. But, you know, the mayor's been trying to wriggle out of that. I mean, obviously, he's recently just axed the recycling centre for Hartcliffe. That's the mayor. But, you know, and it was, we're always finding, you know, when come budget time, that this pool would be sort of one of the things that that officers and the mayor would be trying to knock off or knock back. And Ron would be the first to sort of jump up and down and force it back in. Mm. So it's still a work in progress, but I'd like to think, you know, Ron deserves a lasting tribute, and I'd like to think that whether it's the pool or the new rebuilt community centre in Meadow Vale, that it one of those gets named after him. I think that would be fair and reasonable given the effort he's done.
I agree. I think possibly people don't know that Ron was also an honorary Sikh. We have a Sikh community in Bristol with the temple, and Ron said to me weeks before he passed, "Grenville, could you work through St George in Bloom with the Sikh community there to get to the temple near St George Park, enhanced with flowers?" And it's been a huge honour because I've been there this afternoon and had lunch with the elders there. And, you know, through St George in Bloom, we're going to see if Ron's wishes can come to fruition and we improve the frontage of the Sikh temple this summer. So that would be a huge honour, and he deserves that as well. So, yes, he was a great man.
One of the final shows he did on here, I think actually it was probably in autumn time, he was talking about the leader of the Sikh community here in Bristol, who had apparently got letters, has been here for many years, got letters from the Home Office not long after the general election with the Conservative government coming in, saying, "Right, we've had enough of you, you've got to go home." What's happened about that?
Not sure.
Do you know, Fabian?
I'm not sure, because obviously Ron, that's in St George West, and I'm a St George East councillor. And so that kind of personal casework, but I don't think Kerry would be involved.
I'm sure he would have worked very hard to combat that sort of prejudice.
But it does show that when it comes to kicking people out, this government seems to be picking on soft targets. You know, people who are actually doing something useful in the community, the ones they try and chuck out. People who are actually hate peddlers, it seems to take forever to get rid of. I mean, you know, and so they're just being cowards and picking on soft targets. And
what about the this on the side of the St George Labour Club?
Yes.
This life-size portrait of Tony Benn.
Yeah, well, that was... Ron is a great one for making sure that when other people passed, that tribute was paid to them. And when Tony Benn died, it was Ron who arranged for the local street artist Stewie to paint this tribute stencil on the side of the St George Labour Club. And he also arranged for a limited edition prints to be produced of it that were sold to raise funds for the charity Together for Short Lives. One was emphatic that the money where she got to go to charity, not to a political cause. And I thought that was quite quite something. And I actually bought one of those prints.
You know what? I was thinking maybe I'm right about this impresario business, because you know he got a bit of local talent and sort of George Banksy, basically. That George saying yes, let's do something there, yes. and have a permanent.
Ron said let's do something there.
Yeah,
not George.
Oh, sorry.
Another one where Ron was involved was. With John Deasy, who also tragically died in office a few years back, they'd been working with kids in local primary schools to draw up plans for the new children's play area, you know, the one with that looks like a dragon by the lake. And they went for in the sort of dragon inspired design. And when by the time it opened, Councillor Deasy died, and so Ron had it named after John Deasy because of all the work he'd put in.
And do you remember the shoulder strap with the camera hanging from it? You know, wherever Ron went, he had his camera. He actually was a very accomplished amateur photographer. He was a brilliant photographer.
You could tell Ron was in the house whenever I went into City Hall
and he'd take
pictures. Because you see his camera on the desk somewhere, you think, okay, he's about...
So I know for a fact, you know, through St George in Bloom, he was he volunteered to take all the photos for us and record all we did, which was lovely. And not only that, he donated literally hundreds of photographs that he'd taken to give to us so we could display them. And I think I know that he had his own website. He posted photos up on his Flickr website, all sorts of genre from the city. So somewhere lurking must be thousands, if not millions, a wonderful record of Bristol, actually. Bristol in all its forms, in all its genres, which Ron took.
I think we could do with an art photographic
exhibition
of his best work.
And he'd bring his cameras and say to my partner, what do you think? Because my partner was a professional photographer as well. So they took cameras non-stop.
It's not actually a bad idea taking a camera around with you. You never know what you're going to see. It's
absolutely
one of those things. It's a bit like the journalist's notebook. Always have your notebook with your pen with you. Also, in this day and age, also have your camera with you. Very good idea. You never know what
with digital photography
across.
You can just take reams of stuff.
Well, he was he saw the value, I think, of recording, you know, social change in many ways.
Well, and we've had quite a lot of that, haven't we?
You know, and so, and you know, Ron was there with the camera snapping away, and he loved his photos and he loved to share them. And the other thing is, I think people may not realise, he bred King Charles Cavalier puppies, and his wife, they were Crufts, official Crufts judges. So he loved wildlife, he loved animals, he loved nature, he loved plants, he loved, you know, St George passionately. And, you know, that's, I think, what we must recognise and honour, that wonderful passion and commitment that he gave to our city over many, many years. And I hope the city officially will also help to recognise all the fabulous work that he did, because that needs to be done.
There's also, you talked about some sort of lasting tribute. Any thoughts about that, what that might be, Fabian?
Well, I've already suggested that longer term, when the pool or the community centre should be, one of them should be named after him. I think that'd be appropriate. People are talking about something more smaller scale in the park, but I think
I think it would be nice, Fabian, if his wife and family...
I think he says more than just a park bench.
Yeah, absolutely. Perhaps a bust, whatever. But I think it would be nice, actually, to engage with the family as well, to see what their views are, his wife and his two children, and because, we do need to do that. I think the city needs to do that.
Well, it wouldn't be complete, would it, without a few clips of Ron?
From, of course not.
Because he was on this show just about a month ago, talking about, I think it was just after the show we did just after the debate on bombing Syria, that Ron came on. And in my introduction, I asked him whether he was a, or whether he was not, a terrorist sympathiser. helping us review this week's news, it's Labour councillor for St George West, Ron Stone. Hi, Ron. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hello. Nice to see you all.
Are you a terrorist sympathiser, Ron?
Well, according to Mr Cameron, yes. In truth, no.
What do you make of the remarks? Because these really have caused a lot of upset across the country, and many people saying, well, you know, this is actually not prime ministerial to say this sort of thing.
Well, I think it's completely offensive, and he should withdraw them. The problem we've got, of course, is he made those comments in Westminster where they've got parliamentary privilege to call anybody anything and get away with it. And, you know, it's a difficult issue that people genuinely should stay their consciences on. And whether they voted one way or the other, the people that felt that there was no actual benefit from it didn't take that decision lightly. And to be called a terrorist, I think, is highly insulting.
Yeah, I think Ron's spot on. I think my worry about the whole Syria thing was that I'm not convinced that Cameron has any idea whose side he's on and who he's actually fighting. He just wants to throw bombs around because, I mean, you know, I'm a hawk when it comes to ISIS. I think they're the most evil fascist operation out there. They're committing appalling crimes against innocent and defenseless human beings, and they need to be taken out. But it needs to be done by people who know what they're doing. And I'm not entirely sure that David Cameron does know what he's doing, and it's not acceptable, you know, to call people terrorist sympathisers simply for disagreeing with his tactics is just appalling. But I've no time for Cameron anyway. He's a compulsive liar. He just throws insults and scores points. He's even trying to score points when Jeremy Corbyn's trying to hold him to account over his catastrophic failure over the floods.
But I think Ron always gave a measured response.
Yes, he did.
You know, he would think about it very carefully, and he'd give a very fair and measured response.
Ron was talking about the conflict in the Middle East in terms of Richard the Lionheart and Saladin. He was saying, what was going on over there is just a kind of rerun of the medieval crusades. I mean, that's quite a fascinating position to take, in that he's saying, well, hang on, not a lot has changed. We were hearing earlier on about not a lot of changes with the Bullingdon Club since Victorian times. And what he was saying, I think, was absolutely apposite, which is not a lot has changed for hundreds of years. Mm. There's still a similar kind of thing going on. You know, obviously, back in medieval times, there were horrendous atrocities as well on both sides.
Yeah. Mm. Interesting idea. I think my personal feeling is I think it's a bit like World War One and World War Two. World War One wasn't justified. Humiliating Germany at the end wasn't justified. That led to the rise of fascism in Germany. It led to the absolutely essential World War Two to take out fascism. I had my doubts about and opposed the Iraq war back in 2003. I didn't think it was justified. I didn't see a link between Saddam, whether he was a nice bloke or not, and obviously he wasn't, and 9/11 and the terrorist atrocities there. There was no plan for rebuilding Iraq afterwards. That led to a vacuum which ISIS have filled, and now we have an entirely justifiable situation where we've got to take them out.
Anyway, Ron wasn't so much interested in that as basic things like housing and homelessness, and he talked about that back in December too. I understand you've been discussing housing today, Ron.
Yes.
If you could just give us a report back from that. What's been going on?
Well, I had a meeting with various members of the Labour Party and Marvin with Joe Anderson, the Mayor of Liverpool.
This is your Mayor candidate?
Yes, and obviously what will happen... Bristol's got a housing crisis that we've discussed before. We've got a totally unacceptable number of somewhere between 12,000 and 14,000 people on a waiting list, and we need to do something radical about it. But what we've got to change is the council's attitude to this problem.
So what are they doing in Liverpool, and can we learn from that here in Bristol, and is Mayor Ferguson likely to listen?
Well, yes. I mean, what they've done there is they had a number of voided properties that were shut up and derelict, and they sold them to people for a pound. and they took them on redecorated and made them better. And instead of having the cost of having to work through a program of renewal, it was done by housing agencies, interested parties and whatever. And so it made use of accommodation that is available much more quicker and easier. And that's one thing that we need to look at. But also, we've got plans for eco-homes on 85 sites in the city that meet the highest eco standard and leave you with a bill in the highest winter quarter of £20 for heating it. And in using the 85 sites, we save money from not fly-tipping and having to clear it up and keep those sites clean. And so we've got very close, if you like, parallel ideas to Liverpool, but what we need to do is to build the partnerships between the RSLs and the housing associations.
An RSL? What's an
RSL? Well, it's the housing association structures and ourselves to be able to do that.
I mean, we've been talking about this for years, Ron. Council's got loads of property. Why don't you just let people move in and renovate it?
Well, this is the point. I've just asked questions and got the answers to how many houses we've got on our books that are void at the minute. It's 587.
Okay, so if some squatters move in and they start renovating one of your houses, are you going to evict them?
Well, in the past, yes. In the future, hopefully not. If they're there for a proper reason and we can find a way of working with that group, then I think we should be able to work with that and to get these properties out with people living in them.
But will the mayor wear that?
Probably not, which is why we need to change the city mayor.
But I mean, I saw him
May.
On Points West last week, I think it was, saying, here's a nice bit of property, we need to get it sorted out for Christmas for Bristol's homeless. We've got too many and an explosion in people sleeping rough in the city.
Well, I know that, but I'm afraid he and his bureaucracy that he sits on top of only work within the housing revenue account and the headroom in it, and are not radically thinking outside the box.
No, I mean, you're talking about here about squatters who are prepared to do places up for nothing. You're not talking about it costing the council anything, apart from if they decide to evict them.
Well, I'll believe it if he's saying that when he does it, because he's had 3.5 years to actually do something about the housing list, and virtually nothing's happened.
I think Ron's absolutely right, or was absolutely right. Housing is George's biggest failure. 12 to 14,000 on the waiting list, and nothing's been done for them. I've always had the impression that George is only interested in certain classes and certain communities, you know, and they all tend to, the kind of people he's interested in, you know, have their own homes anyway, so the social housing crisis doesn't matter because that's in sort of the poor areas that George isn't really interested in.
Grenville, did you come across George? I keep saying George, I shouldn't say that, should I? Ron's interest in housing and the homelessness,
yes,
that sort of thing?
Actually, when he used to pop in, as I mentioned before, on a weekly basis, and we'd have a cuppa and a piece of cake, Ron would not confide in me, but he'd share his views and his passions and his concerns privately with me and say, what do you think, mate? What do you think if I did so-and-so? From that last interview clip, he not only identified the problem, but he identified potential solutions,
yep,
practical ones, quick fix ones that would actually make a huge impact very quickly for the common good. That's the type of man he was. You know, often he'd, when I talked to him, he'd say, well, yes, and I've talked about this, and I can see that if we did that, and he'd get quite frustrated, I know, at times, because he'd use the term to me, I've put my head above the parapet, mate, again. He'd stick his head above the parapet and say what he felt was fair and just and proper. And
maybe worth mentioning that Jeff Gollop from the Conservatives was on here just before Christmas. We were talking about some of these things with him, and he was quite happy to admit that when you've got a lot of housing stock that the council own, you've got a lot of homeless people, and if some of those homeless people could be put together with that housing stock to renovate it, those people might actually be considered entrepreneurs doing something to sort their own situation out without costing the council necessarily anything.
I think there's got to be a lot of thinking outside the box. There's a lot of, you know, I think, you know, letting people buy or rent stuff that needs working, that needs work, and letting having it for very little, and then doing it up is going to be a lot cheaper, because the council spends an absolute fortune. When it gets a void property, it completely refits it. That must cost an arm and a leg, and it's a void for months. If somebody's desperately homeless, they probably don't give a monkey's if it's not quite perfect, not the latest kitchen or bathroom.
And they, actually, they may have...
They just want a roof so they're dry and warm.
And also, they may have some of those skills. So
and they may well have some of those skills, yes, I mean, yeah.
And Ron would support that. He'd identify, you know, where people had those skills or that potential, or if a community had that, you know, that expertise lying there. He'd light the firework and set it going, and that was one of his skills, you know, and one of his compassionate, you know, beliefs that he could do that, and he did, and that was the great thing, and I think that's why he will be missed, because, you know, he did all these innovative, he brought these innovative ideas to the city, to the council.
One of the things that Ron, one of the words Ron was not afraid to use was the C word, and I'm talking about corruption, and he's talking about effectively white collar crime, with assets that are public assets being sold off for much less than they're actually worth. We heard earlier on about the Bristol port, didn't we? Potentially worth up to something like £1 billion, and then being sold off for 10 million.
It's outrageous. Just completely unforgivable. And now that it's in private hands, they can do what the hell they want with it.
Yeah,
and we've lost our stake as a city.
If we go back a few years, I was talking about some of this. This is, I think this is from about 2011, this interview with Ron about corruption generally, and he certainly was prepared to call a spade a spade.
It's a little bit worrying, isn't it, Ron, when you think that a promise made by a Member of Parliament, that's Jack Napressi there, the MP for Filton and Bradley Stoke, can be overruled by the Grand Master at the bottom of Park Street.
I mean, I've listened to that, and in the words of Dickens, bah humbug. Can I just say, in relation to my experience with masonry as a parliamentary candidate, and this was in North Somerset, and a farmer came to me, and he was being made bankrupt by his bank, and it was because the bank claimed that he was in competition with the bank in trying to buy some grazing land, and that they would close his accounts, etc., and he had to stop bidding for it. He had been with the bank for probably 30 years, and he was so angry, he took his money out the bank and invested it in another one. When he asked why, and the questions, what came out of those incidents was that the senior officials of the bank, and indeed, because he took it to the fraud squad in Bristol, that senior members of the police were in the same Masonic lodge, and nothing was going to be done. And what I arranged for was the front bench shadow agricultural minister to meet him. They organised a farm sale, sold all his stock, sold all his machinery, withdrew his credit, and tried to force him off his farm. And what it unearthed in the end was a complete conspiracy through North Wales into south parts of England, where small farmers and smallholders were being forced out of business, and the farms were being turned over for housing and profit. And that was all done through masonry. And when I stood a second time, I had a second incident with small builders in exactly the same way. So saying that they work for charity and they work for the greater good, I'm afraid I don't believe it.
That was Ron talking from a few years ago about his experiences as a parliamentary candidate, Fabian.
Well, obviously I've not been a parliamentary candidate, but yeah, I mean, there is corruption in Britain, and we do need, but it's not something I've got that involved in.
And I mean, my experience of this sort of thing is that there's a fine line between corruption and fraud. So if you're selling something off and it goes to somebody who's one of your friends, it's very difficult to prove that there's been any kind of kickback from it. And in a way, it's a similar thing what we were hearing about earlier on from the Bullingdon Club, where you've got somebody who's meeting up with one of their Oxford friends from many years ago, one of whom is a leader writer on a national newspaper, another one is a banker, another one happens to be the Chancellor of the Exchequer or the Prime Minister, that they can do favours for each other, and it's very
but
difficult.
But a lot of that's down to privilege and connection, isn't it? It's about people going to from wealthy families, going to the right schools, going to the right universities, and therefore building their connections. And you'll get people who are not too bright, but have the right from the right stock and the right back, you know, get into the better universities, and therefore, you know. And I think part of that's the problem. You get sharper, you know, if it was purely about talent, you'd have sharper minds from more humbler backgrounds in charge of things a bit more.
Okay, in a sentence, first you, Grenville, then you, Fabian. How's Ron going to be remembered?
Well, I think as a great, loyal, generous friend of St George, a man who made huge changes for the good, and will be fondly remembered. And, you know, he'll be a hard act to follow.
Yeah. He remembered as a sort of a community champion. I mean, 30 years, he was elected in 1985. That was when I was doing my A-levels at school. And he's been held office ever since, been re-elected every time without a break. He'll be remembered as a community champion and a champion of those struggling with life.
Well, thanks very much to Fabian Breckles, City Councillor on the Labour Group, and also one of Ron Stone's very close friends, Grenville Johnston there. Thanks also to our guest in the first hour, leader of the Green Group, Annie Stafford Townsend. And on our sister show Dialect, you can hear much more, particularly about Avonmouth. That's dialectradio.co.uk. Every BCFM show is available online. This show, particular show, is thisweek.org.uk, and that takes you straight to this show and its links and its archives. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. And whatever you do, don't let the banksters get you down.
National news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.